Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and welcome to part two of War, What Is It Good For? Last week, we spoke to U.S. soldier Kevin Benderman, who refused to be redeployed to Iraq in 2005 after witnessing horrors and being ordered to do things that were very unconscionable to him. Today, we have Raed Jarrar. Raed is an Arab-American architect, blogger, and political advocate based in the U.S. capital of Washington, D.C. now. Raed was born in Iraq and raised in Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq. He's half Iraqi and half Palestinian. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with my very special guest, Raed Jarrar. Raed Jarrar, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you're on our part two show of War, What Is It Good For? Last week, I interviewed a soldier, Kevin Benderman, who refused to go back to be redeployed to Iraq in 2005 because his first deployment there, he really witnessed the horrors of the U.S. military on the people of Iraq. I mean, up to being ordered to shoot children just for climbing on a fence.
Wow.
And of course, he didn't do it, but he refused to go back. So, Raed, your situation is special, and before we get into that, can you just tell my listeners a little bit about yourself?
I am an Iraqi-American. I was born in Iraq, and I'm a U.S. citizen. I'm also of Palestinian descent. My father is from Palestine, from Jenin.
Mm.
And so I'm half Iraqi and half Palestinian by birth, because my mother is Iraqi and my father is Palestinian. And my wife is from Iran. So,
wow.
I have connections with a lot of countries in the Middle East. My family is still living around between Egypt and Jordan, mostly in Jordan. But I have family literally all over the region, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Emirates or Egypt or Iran, and I've lived in most of these countries as well. I moved to the U.S. in 2005, so a couple of years after the U.S. invasion. I was in Baghdad during the invasion and left with my family in 2004. And I've been living in the U.S. Since 2005, so it's been a decade since I immigrated here.
So you did something that got quite a bit of media attention. I don't remember what year it was, but you were refused entry onto an airplane for wearing a T-shirt. Can you tell my listeners, refresh their memories? Because I'm sure many people will remember it after you talk about it.
Right. That happened less than a year after I came to the U.S. I wasn't even a U.S. citizen yet. I had a green card at the time. In August of 2006, I was stopped by the TSA and JetBlue security officials.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't let me board on the plane because I was wearing a T-shirt that read, "We will not be silent," in both Arabic and English. It had so many ironies, of course, because the T-shirt says, "We will not be silent," and I was being silenced by the security authorities. But, of course, in my case, the larger irony is that I just left Iraq and had to find a new home because of a war that was waged at that time in the name of democracy and freedom.
Right.
So it was particularly ironic that I would get stopped in the U.S. and get my freedoms taken away in New York, you know, not only in Baghdad.
I got arrested for wearing a t-shirt at the State of the Union address in 2006. So those dangerous t-shirts, they're really a threat to the empire.
Everything for national security, Cindy.
Absolutely. So was it March, like the 20th, you and I participated in Washington, D.C. in a teach-in, and our panel was about ISIS and, you know, who really is ISIS and, you know, what should the anti-war response be to it. And you did talk about shock and awe and your family being involved in that. But you really pointed out some things that people really need to remember, that George Bush wasn't the first president to bomb Iraq, that the United States has a long history of that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, George Bush wasn't the first president, nor the last president, unfortunately, to bomb Iraq. President Obama is the fourth consecutive U.S. president to wage war on Iraq. Bombs started falling on Baghdad and the rest of Iraq in January of 1991. So I was in my eighth grade at the time. And those bombs never stopped falling. We're still dropping bombs in Iraq until this day. The excuses given to justify the U.S. military intervention have shifted a lot. They went from saving Iraq's neighbors from Iraq to, you know, saving Iraqi minorities from each other, finding weapons of mass destruction, to democracy, to now, the latest chapter in this long list of excuses to justify military intervention has been extremism and ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and as if these groups came out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. I think the mainstream narrative now is that there is violence in these countries because Muslims are violent and right. Their religion is violent. That is the mainstream narrative. And that's why we hear all the time about different ways to explain Islam to Muslims, to let them know that, you know, that they have some misunderstandings with the book, invest in education systems. And, you know, I appreciate trying to understand religions, whether it's Islam or Christianity or Judaism or whatever. Many religions have been used historically to justify violence, and it's awesome to try to find the peaceful readings in all of these religions. But to claim that violence in Iraq is happening because of religious extremism and that is the root cause of violence is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to look at the actual root causes of violence, the root causes that led to the void, the vacuum in Iraq these days, the root causes that destroyed the Iraqi central government, its institutions, and the Iraqi identity. You know, the violence that created the policies that created militias and ethnic and sectarian identities and paramilitaries. So when you look back at what happened, you know, in the last 23 years of U.S. intervention, ISIS is only a very small chapter. It's a symptom of a larger problem of destruction, of trying to divide Iraq into ethnic and sectarian enclaves, of supporting chaos in Iraq by different international and regional actors. So I always talk about ISIS as a problem. Of course, ISIS is a problem. But trying to solve ISIS by, you know, talking about ISIS without understanding why we have groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Shiite militias or Kurdish militias will not get us out of the current loop. It's actually, if we get stuck in that discussion, it only reaffirms the current narrative, that this violence is happening because of religious extremism, and it's actually harmful to fall in that trap. We have to remember why this violence started, to be able to give real solutions for it.
Well, Riyad, you know, in many ways, Bill Clinton, the Democrat, was more harmful to Iraq than the subsequent presidents. And many of the policies, not just his foreign policy, but domestic policy of Bill Clinton, is responsible for where we are today. And now his wife is going to run for president. It'll probably be a Clinton-Bush 2016. And I just like feel like tearing my hair out. So like, you said, it's very important for Americans, especially, you know, the United States of Americans. I call them USAENs because, you know, I don't want to confuse North Americans with South Americans who have been the victims of empire and understand it more than we do. But it's very important for, you know, people here in the United States to understand these things that you are talking about. I was just like flabbergasted on our panel when I heard one of our fellow panelists say that it's too late to undo what the United States has done in that region. Now we have to have a limited bombing campaign against ISIS because they're bad guys and hopefully not too many civilians will be killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, this has been the narrative all along, that we hate violence and we hate dropping bombs, but we just have to do it this week because otherwise some baby will get killed or some woman will get oppressed or some group of gays and lesbians will lose their rights. We have to step in because it's our, you know, humanitarian intervention responsibility. It's our burden as a nation to go save the weak. And this is something that is, it makes me feel disgusted when I see how many people's good intentions get manipulated by our politicians in that way. Because there is a good, you know, majority of Americans who are actually, you know, meaning they have good intentions towards the rest of the world, towards Iraq and towards Syria. They're not supporting us to interfere in Iraq and Syria because they hate Iraqis or they want to kill Muslims. And, you know, there are those people too, but I'm saying the majority of people are tricked into believing that throwing a bomb from 30,000 feet would save a child, and that's why sometimes they are tolerant to it, or in some cases supportive of it. And do you remember, Cindy, we had this discussion many times about how many feminist and women groups were tricked into supporting the invasion of Afghanistan, because the Taliban were bad men and they were oppressing their wives. Let's go there and liberate the wives with our tank. And people fall for this, unfortunately. It's very easy for us, and for people who are listening to the show today, it's very easy for us to say we shouldn't bomb Iraq because we shouldn't steal their oil. I think I guarantee you that 100% of your listeners will say yes. Or we shouldn't bomb Iraq because, you know, we shouldn't be killing Muslims because they are Muslims. People say, of course not. But when it comes to saying, do you want to bomb Iraq to save the Yazidis from a genocide, then people will say, wait a second, maybe we should bomb Iraq. And that's why I think it's more harmful for our constituents these narratives and claims of humanitarian intervention are much more harmful because people fall for it. And people believe that maybe dropping a bomb would make the situation better. I unfortunately had the experience of living through war. Right. And, you know, a small minority of Americans, including your son, Cindy, a small minority had the awful opportunity to see what war is.
Right.
War is ugly. You know, if you survive it or if you don't survive it, it's ugly. It's the ugliest thing I have witnessed. And it's death, it's destruction. It has a smell, it has you know, once you see it, you can't unsee it.
Right.
I always tell people, imagine that from the end of the Vietnam War, where the U.S. lost 58,000 soldiers, there are more than 60,000 others who killed themselves.
Right.
Since then, because they can't live with the memories. You can't unlive it. You can't unsee it. So, unfortunately, Americans don't really know what war is. For many Americans, war is a policy option, you know?
It's a movie.
Maybe we should drop a bomb, you know? Maybe we should invade the country.
It's just something on TV or in the movies.
And then, so that what I'm saying is that war is really ugly, and it's not a policy option. Nothing really happy and good can come out of wars. And I don't believe that invading or bombing can solve problems. Now, of course, the question becomes, so what else should we do? And, you know, many of your listeners asked this. Many of the people who attended the conference that we both spoke at asked the question, okay, you don't want us to bomb. What should we do?
Mm-hmm.
And for that, of course, the answer is long. It, you know, because the destruction that happened in Iraq is so complicated, the real answer is very complicated. I mean, I spoke during the conference about alternative ideas for eliminating extremism. Dropping bombs does not eliminate extremism.
No.
The idea that we can bomb Iraq into moderation is should not pass the lab test. I don't know why people actually think we can bomb a country into moderation and eliminate extremism by dropping more explosives. Eliminating extremism can happen by re-engagement. Like in the case of ISIS, there are many groups in Sunni areas in Iraq who are more moderate than ISIS, who have more legitimate grievances that can be addressed through the political system. We can reach out to them. Either the U.S. or the Iraqi central government can reach out to them and try to re-engage them in the political process. Peeling off support from extremism is one way to kill it. Now, when we drop bombs on moderate groups and ISIS together, we're actually helping them unite. We're becoming a force of unification for extremism and helping extremism thrive by taking this foreign military action. When we send our weapons and troops, when we send our weapons and support and money to Shiite militias and other sectarian militias who have been committing ethnic cleansing and crimes that are as bad as ISIS, you know, of course we will end up pushing the country towards more terrorism and extremism. So we have to watch our actions in Iraq first. That's number one. We shouldn't send more troops and support, you know, human rights violators. And there are many different ways to ensure that. And number two, to have a vision that would end the plan to divide Iraq into these sectarian and ethnic groups and the militias that are implementing the plan. Now, that vision doesn't exist because the United States' official policy until this day is still supporting Sunnistan and the Shiastan and the Kurdistan. And without rethinking that policy and saying the U.S. will respect Iraq as one united country and we will not push for dividing Iraq into regions, this destruction and death and sectarianism and militias and ISIS will continue to thrive.
Well, and then, like you said, what region would you go to?
Exactly. I mean, that's, you know, I made that joke during the conference because I'm half Sunni and half Shiite in addition to all of the halves and halves that I have. So, like, people like myself, where would we end? You know, and it's not a small minority, you know, especially in Baghdad and other urban areas. There are many, many families that are mixed sectarian or ethnic families. Where would we end? You know, the other question is, you know, once you divide this Iraq demographically, aren't you committing ethnic and sectarian cleansing? The answer to that question is yes. That's exactly what has been going on for 12 years now. There are 5 or 6 million Iraqis who were moved out of their homes in the last 12 years. And most of them were moved because of this sectarian and ethnic cleansing campaign. So the country has been reorganized based on the idea that Sunnis should live together and Shiites live together. It's a very sophisticated plan. It's not like some stupid violence happening. Very sophisticated. People were kicked out of their homes in neighborhoods to clean up neighborhoods. All Shiites attacked in that neighborhood, or Sunnis attacked in this neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Just think about it. You know, people are going around with the database and names and addresses and burning homes based on these identities. I showed pictures from the last report by Human Rights Watch, which is still on their website, and I encourage all of your audience to check it out on hrw.org. It's mind-boggling to see the ethnic cleansing committed by Iraqi forces and Shiite militias. They know exactly which homes to go in and burn and kick out their residents. It's an illegal campaign. It's a war crime. And unfortunately, it's funded by our tax dollars.
I'm just writing down Human Rights Watch so I can make sure to link that. I just want people to think, too, is like, what if here in the United States, like, we were told we have to go with our origins or whatever. You know, most of us would have to be divided into 10 or 20 pieces to go with German, English, Indian, whatever. You know, it's just totally ridiculous.
Correct. Yeah, so, I mean, that's a good example for U.S. audiences, I think, to say, imagine if a foreign power would create these enclaves in the U.S. where, you know, exclusively white, like some of them are exclusively white, some of them are exclusively Hispanic. And then we'll have tens of millions of Americans kicked out of their homes and pushed to those other areas against their will. Now, in Iraq, the situation is even worse because, you know, Iraqi Sunnis and Iraqi Shiites didn't really come from different continents or, you know, immigrated to Iraq. Now, they've been living there for thousands of years. And the destruction of the demographic fabric is really hard to explain because Iraq is such an old country. Unlike, you know, in the U.S., of course, people have lived in the United States for thousands of years as well before the U.S. existed as a country. And those, you know, Native Americans have similar history to the history of Iraqis, like that indigenous. But, you know, for us, it's harder in this United States of America to understand that demographic, you know, depth because most of the people here now that we know have come either this generation or a few generations back. So thinking in Iraq, you know, some people have been there for literally 1,000 and 2,000 and 3,000 years. So thinking that they're being kicked out of their homes for no reason, for no fault, after these thousands of years of living in the same place, it's just so heartbreaking.
Same thing in Palestine. People living in their homes for generations, centuries, you know, get displaced by the colonizers. It's the same
Correct.
Story.
So I was looking at my Palestinian family tree, and Palestinians take a lot of pride in their heritage and lineage. So our naming system in Palestine, my name, is the way that names work are very different than the U.S. My full name is my name, then my father's name, and my grandfather's name, and my great-grandfather's name, and then my family name. That's my official name. Mm-hmm. So in my passport, my name says Ra'id Azam Kamil Sharif Jarrar. That's my name.
Mm-hmm.
So people, you know, take so much pride in that, and it's for a reason. Like when I meet another person who's a Jarrar or from a different family, I can tell, you know, who they are, where did they live, etc., just based on their name. So I was looking at my family's tree and tracing it back from my father and, you know, his father and my great grandfather. It's traced back almost 16 or 17 generations.
Wow.
They were all born within 20 minutes walking of each other.
Wow.
And I was born in a different country. you know? And I ended up moving all the way to a different continent. And my son was born in Washington, D.C. But when you think about it, you know, like you have this family that has been for hundreds of years, you know, marrying and living in the same exact village, you know? And then, of course, what happened to Palestinians is as painful as what's going on now with the Iraqis, you know? Half of the Palestinians in the world are living outside of historic Palestine. They were kicked out of their homes in waves, you know? So, I mean, I'm just thinking at that, looking at that tree and thinking, how crazy it is that all of my ancestors for generations and generations were born in this one village. And I ended up being born in Iraq, and I'm living in Washington, D.C. now. And my kid is born thousands of miles away from Jenin, you know?
Right, because of imperialism. And it's just really... It's really tragic, and like you said, I just want to get people who live in this country to understand these situations. And you know, a lot of people come here because of, you know, oppression, and but we don't really accept as many refugees as, you know, the average American would like to think that we do. But before we get, because we are running out of time, and you talked about, you know, how a lot of people say, oh, we have to go in and save the women. And so many people, I think I spoke about this at the conference, many people would tell me, oh, Cindy, but you don't care about the women of Iraq because we're liberating them. And I would say, what, are you kidding me? You know, the women of Iraq are doctors and engineers and professors and anything you can think of, very highly educated professionals. And I got the privilege of spending some time with your mom in Washington, D.C. And your mom is just one badass woman that really didn't need the U.S. Army to come and liberate her. So do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Of course, yeah. I mean, I think you should maybe have my mom on your show one day in the future, because
yes, please,
she's
connect,
pretty good in talking about herself.
I want to be reconnected with your mom, but, you know, talk about, you don't have to specifically talk about your mom, but talk about that myth of the U.S. Army liberated the women of Iraq.
I mean, Iraq had one of the most vibrant feminist and women movements in the region. And there was a revolution that Iraqi women went through in the 50s and 60s and 70s. So my grandmother is illiterate. She didn't go to school. She can't read and write. And my mother is a civil engineer. My mother was a feminist, an activist at school, a singer, and she was, you know, a very successful, she is still a successful civil engineer and political activist. So when you think about it, you know, like, I always give this example of my mom, one of my favorite stories about her in the 60s and 70s, how she used to get in arguments with men on the bus if they stood up to let her sit down, because she thought that men and women are equal, and by, you know,
right.
standing up, you know, there is some implication there that she's less of a human than them. So, I mean, she comes from that radical school of feminism. Of course, you know, after the U.S.-led invasion, my mother stopped being able to leave the house by herself. Security situation deteriorated, and she ended up leaving the country like many other women. I want to give you another example of another woman that I met once who was a little bit younger than my mother. She had a PhD from Europe. So she traveled there in the 80s and finished her PhD. She spoke three languages, and her mother was illiterate as well. And her daughter, who is now around 7 or 8 years old, her daughter was not being sent to school. And that broke my heart. Mm-hmm. It was such an image, this like historic image, iconic image of Iraqi women. You have a grandmother who's illiterate, a mother who is you know, extremely educated, well-educated, speaks multiple languages, lived all around the world, speaks for herself, and then a daughter who will unfortunately grow up to be illiterate as well. So, I mean, that is the legacy of the U.S. invasion and occupation, that seven-year-old who can't go to school.
I was in another country, I think it was somewhere in Scandinavia, and I met a professor of, you know, a medical professor from the University of Baghdad, I think. And she was telling me they don't even have microscopes anymore, that they have to draw pictures of the germs for their exams.
Mm-hmm. And mind you, this is a country that is the richest country in the region. Iraq's GDP, the annual income for Iraq, is larger than Jordan and Syria and Lebanon and Egypt combined. We're talking about these four countries with over four times the population of Iraq. Iraq's income is more than their income, and Iraq does not have the most basic needs: electricity, water, you know, decent streets, let alone security and stability.
So sad, so pitiful. So, Ryan, thank you so much for being on the show. But how can my listeners, like, get more information about your current work and what are you doing right now?
Sure. I work with the American Friends Service Committee, so I encourage everyone to check out our website. It is afsc.org. I have an active Twitter account, so I'm on Twitter, and my Twitter handle is my first name, last name, so R-A-E-D-J-A-R-R-A-R. I think between my organization's website and my Twitter, you can know everything about my life.
I know too much. So it was so nice to reconnect with you in D.C., and it was really great having you on my show. And like I said, we just really need to a war is ugly. And, you know, the ugliest thing about war is it's barbaric and it's not necessary. Yet we still do it.
Correct. It's good for some people's business.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's why we keep, I'm unfortunately doing it over and over and over again. Well, Rod Gerard, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and my love to you and your entire family.
Thank you so much for having me, and keep up the great work.
Thank you.
That's Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox for today. I hope you were inspired and informed. Really, share this show with everybody you know. It's so important these days. Riad gave some amazing information and backup on ISIS and what is really going on in the Middle East and what we can do to solve it. Share it with your friends who supported Bush, support Obama's so-called humanitarian wars, or really just have no clue about what's going on truly in the world. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, my assistant, Dee Dee Miller. I'd like to thank my very special guest, Ra-Ed Gerard. And as always, I'd like to thank you mostly for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.